I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Charlotte Street Foundation turned 20 this year, quite a milestone for any organization, especially for one that supports metro area artists. Most notable is this annual grant of $10,000 to those creators of outstanding visual and performance art. But has that award and the foundation's other work made things easier for Kansas City's starving artist types? Are we a city that attracts and keeps creatives around for the long haul? Today, how the art community has changed over the past two decades and how much of that change is because of the work of the Charlotte Street Foundation. Then the latest State House blend, Missouri. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Charlotte Street Visual Artist Awards are now 20 years old. Over the years, more than 100 artists have received this marker of excellence in both the visual and performing arts fields. We're talking about unrestricted grants that began as $2,500 awards and now have grown to $10,000 each. The Charlotte Street Foundation now also provides free studio space and grants aimed at promoting risk-taking public arts projects. All in all, the fund is seen as a glue that brings Kansas City artists together and fosters this town's thriving art scene. With us today to talk about the Charlotte Street Foundation are David Hughes. He's the founder of Charlotte Street Foundation. And David, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve.
Amy Kligman is the current Charlotte Street Executive and Artistic Director. She won the Charlotte Street Award back in 2014. Amy, good morning to you.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
James Woodfill is a former Charlotte Street Award winner, too. He's now an associate professor in the painting department over at the Kansas City Art Institute. Jim, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you.
Well, David, when you first began this back in 1997, did you see this thing surviving all the way to 2017, 20 years later?
I don't think I had any concept of a length of time, but I saw unlimited potential. I saw so much underground activity and so many wonderful artists doing cool work that were kind of unknown at the time. And I saw just great potential for the city, I would say.
So how gratifying is this for you as you sit here today, 20 years down the road?
Yeah, it's hugely gratifying. It's so exciting what's happening. I had a dancer friend in town over the weekend. He was performing in Lawrence, in from New York, and he was here years ago, and he was just blown away walking around the city one of the evenings this weekend in terms of all that's going on. And I think it's gratifying because I think so many people have made Charlotte Street what it is. Obviously, many, many, many people have made the city what it is, but Charlotte Street, I think, has been a vehicle, a vessel, if you will, through which a lot of artists and different kinds of people have made it work.
You know, Amy, there's maybe no coincidence to some people listening out there that the arts community here began to thrive about 20 years ago, and today is regarded by many as such an important part of our community. How responsible is Charlotte Street for what we're seeing out there these days when it comes to this art community that everyone attaches this adjective thriving to?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that Charlotte Street has been pretty critical to that. Of course, the results of that effort has been a community effort. So it's not just Charlotte Street. There is a number of partnering organizations, individual artists that are pursuing projects and things. But Charlotte Street has been very systematic in thinking about here's what will make the scene interesting right now. What if we throw this in the mix? What if we think about this thing that's missing? Charlotte Street's been a very proactive catalyst for artists who are natural catalysts themselves. So there's a giant domino effect that happens there.
Mm-hmm. Jim, how do you see the importance of Charlotte Street and the foundation now, again, the impact over 20 years?
Well, I don't think you can underestimate it in any way. It's changed things significantly. The public programming and outreach we were talking about earlier has shifted the landscape drastically in Kansas City. As a working artist, it's provided me with numerous dozen or more opportunities to exhibit it has allowed me to encounter interactions with curators from around the country. It's massive.
Is that because Charlotte Street provided something of someone overlooking the entire scene who could run interference for artists in a sense, Jim, and look for opportunities that maybe the artists themselves didn't have time to go searching for?
It's that, and it's also empowering the artists themselves to invent. And one of the things that I've said before when we've talked about Charlotte Street is that it was for a long time kind of this cloud of possibilities where everything was possible and everything got done, and then things started to congeal in different ways around the best of the ideas. And so it's formed organically and methodically around the idea of empowering the artists to work for themselves and to speak for themselves.
And letting them know what opportunities are out there, it sounds
like. That's right.
Yeah. Yep. Amy, tell us about an artist who's received a bounce out of this program and how it's affected them.
Sure. You know, I have a good relationship with someone, Rodolfo Marone III, who is a recent award winner. He won the award last year. And he's been telling his story a lot, and I think it's really interesting to hear. He grew up on the West Side, which is near La Esquina, where Charlotte Street that's a Charlotte Street venue, but it's also near our offices. And, you know, as he was kind of coming up out of high school, he had an opportunity to exhibit with Charlotte Street. They were doing a program with students that is kind of unusual for us, actually, but he was able to exhibit in one of our spaces. And, you know, he talks about, wow, look, I'm excited about this. There's this thing happening right here by my home. And so he... when he came out of school, he actually didn't choose to go to college, but he did enter into our residency program and, you know, got some exposure through that residency program to other curators, to other artists, started working in collaborations. He ended up getting a museum exhibition at the Nerman Museum of Art, which was amazing. And then, again, last year, he was an award winner and had a museum exhibition at the Kemper. So, you know, in a very short time, at a young age, had having these successes kind of build up. And then this year, he's actually a recipient of a residency at Art Omai, which is an international residency in New York State. Hmm. And it's something that Charlotte Street, it's a relationship that Charlotte Street has had for a long time with Art Omai, that we send one artist every year. And they choose the artist from our list of fellows.
This residency program you're describing for Charlotte Street, what is that?
Yeah, so we have a residency program here that is on the sixth floor of Town Pavilion, and that space has changed over the years. It's not always been at Town Pavilion. It kind of uses underutilized downtown office space, and we provide free spaces for artists to work. Right now, there's over 30 artists in that residency. They have free space for a year. It's mixed disciplines, so it's not just visual artists. It's musicians, performers, writers, dancers. So that opportunity is really fantastic, not just because it's free space for people to work, but also because, you know, there's a great peer cohort there. There's a lot of visibility. There are exhibition opportunities and curators that visit. And it's really, there's a lot of opportunities that come up out of it.
David, I had this sense in my mind, this picture in my head of artists and dancers and other creative people sitting around at 2 a.m., you know, drinking beers and talking about the road ahead and the possibilities in the free space that Amy just described here.
Originally, you mean? Or,
well, just
or in
even
this
today.
Space? Yeah, even
yeah.
Today. I think artists and people in the arts community are always both dreaming and complaining and dreaming about what the possibilities are, and nobody's ever happy with, you know, where we are now. So, I mean, I'm an old fart. I'm out of it, if you will, a bit, trying to still help out from the side. But over the years, I think the collaboration and the community spirit that the arts community has in thinking about the future and in pulling together and trying to make it happen has been amazing. And, that continues today.
Where does the money from the program come from?
It comes from generous individuals and corporations and foundations.
Here in town?
Here in town. Although we have, I think, over the years been successful in getting out-of-town money from Warhol Foundation, Ford Foundation, others, kind of unusually so, in terms of money coming from elsewhere. I think that speaks somewhat to the quality of the programming, that national funders would come and support something small in Kansas City. But by and large, it's the generosity of local individuals and foundations.
So your original idea for this thing was what did you want to see happen? What was the whole point of it when you began 20 years ago?
I had moved back to town from New York and started meeting artists, curators, gallerists, dancers, musicians.
And you saw a big void in what was going on out there.
Well, I saw a lot of amazing individuals doing interesting work. I was at American Century at the time, and other places, but in my corporate experience and limited philanthropic experience, no one at those levels had any idea what was going on at the grassroots level. And I really had a huge education coming from artists, curators, gallerists, et cetera, in terms of just looking at work, understanding, appreciating, getting excited about it, but also that artists need support. And it was a bad time in terms of the culture wars nationally. You know, those are back, kind of. But the NEA was under fire. Missouri had, I think, individual artist grants had dried up at the state level. I was just thinking, can I get some money to my friends? I ended up getting $10,000 from American Century and my employer. We met. Had some pulled some curators together and gave away four different awards at $2,500. So I think there are multiple levels, just showing that you care to artists. I mean, they're not supported, they're not considered important.
And did you want to sort of build a foundation under the community here to ensure that it thrived for years to come? And I imagine other cities that have winning arts communities do something like what Charlotte Street does.
No, I think Charlotte Street's very unusual.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I've had many people say, I wish we had a Charlotte Street in our city. There are national efforts that actually followed Charlotte Street. We were among the first to do this. U.S. Artists started much later by the Ford Foundation. Warhol Foundation started something called Creative Capital to support artists nationally. But locally, I mean, there's certainly artist-centric organizations that support their artists in a city or region, but As widespread efforts that Charlotte Street's made, it's kind of unusual, I think. But no, I didn't have any huge grand plan, if you will. I wanted to get started. I wanted to keep learning. I wanted the artists and curators to direct this. And in fact, that's why it succeeded, is because artists and curators have really taken hold and drove Charlotte Street. And the different programs it had.
You know, Amy, you have said that Charlotte Street now gets out-of-town applicants from people who are coming here to work. How common is that? And did that used to happen 10 or 15 years ago?
Well, I wasn't there 15 years ago.
Yeah.
But what I can say is that, you know, I was looking at our residency applicants last year. And again, the residency that I just described, and it's for free space. Part of that is it's not living space. It's just working space. So for artists to take advantage of it, they have to live in Kansas City. They have to kind of be planning to come here and have a home. So it was an interesting trend that in last year, 10% of the artists that were applying from out-of-town metropolitan areas that were not Kansas City. And so, you know, what that said to me was, you know, there are people that are looking at what we're doing that aren't here yet, you know, and they're eager to get here. They're interested in what's happening here. Some of them already had jobs. Some of them did not. But, like, we're planning and trying to patch together the things that would make it work. And I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. David?
Artists are moving to town. I mean, that's something that really wasn't true 20 years ago. And the Arts Council has done some measurement over the years, and it, you know, it's not a huge number, but it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are finding their way into our residency in order to, as a way of getting exposure to the community and learn about the community.
Jim, have you noticed that too?
Oh, yeah.
It's
you know, when I graduated from the Art Institute in 1980, there were a handful of us that stayed, and it was a very kind of small and succinct art community, and that just kept growing and growing. And I think when Charlotte Street started, that condition got amplified, and a lot more a lot more students stayed in Kansas City after after they got out of school. And with the residency program now, especially, that's one of the strong career paths for artists coming out of the studio, out of the school, to try to compete and get into the Charlotte Street residency program.
That's a prestigious thing for young artists.
Oh, absolutely, it is. It has become quite a goal to try to match. And as that happens, the word is out. It was a few years ago that we started seeing graduates from other art schools coming to Kansas City after they were done instead of graduate school. And with MFAs becoming incredibly expensive and different alternative paths, this is one of them, and this is a really good one, I think.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about the Charlotte Street Foundation, which supports artists in town on any through any number of different programs. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is the number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. David, you know, these grants are unrestricted, meaning that the recipient can do anything he or she wants to do with them. And I'm wondering, you know, is this idea sort of tailored after the MacArthur Genius Grant idea where, you know, the phone rings one day and suddenly, you know, someone's picked out of the ether to win $100,000 from the MacArthur Foundation folks?
Yeah, I think they give a lot more money away than we have, but...
but you're getting there.
But we're working on it.
Yeah.
It was tailored... I mean, I don't know how long that one's been around. I'm sure quite a while. It wasn't really tailored after anything. I mean, it was just an idea on its own, and we did check around in terms of who else was doing this to artists around the country, and there wasn't much. But the idea of unrestricted, I think, is important because you want to trust artists to do, you don't want to restrict it, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. And they do what kinds of things with it?
Well, I think they do everything from fund some travel, buy some beer, buy some canvases, some new instruments, work on their studio. It's pay down student debt.
Yeah. Take a load off in one way or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jim. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in my case, when I got a grant, it was part of my sustainability. Mm-hmm. I was a working artist.
You needed food.
I needed food, and yeah. I needed to pay mortgage, and I needed so it was part of my. It was a substantial part of what let me keep going another few months, right? And that's a big thing to working artists.
Well, what point in the year, Amy, do you make phone calls to let people know they've won?
At the very beginning. It's a good way to kick off the year. We're kind of in the process early on in the year. And then we made decisions in, I think it was March, we were announcing this year. And that's the best part of this job, actually, is being able to call artists and say,
I've got some news for you.
Yeah. And I actually still remember my call from Kate Hackman when I won the award.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that those are really critical moments for people where suddenly you feel validated. You feel like, oh, wait, you know, this thing I'm doing, it's a real thing. It's not a fake thing. It's not a hobby thing. It's a, you know, it's a real thing. And people actually are noticing what I'm doing.
That's such a big deal for artists who, if I have come to know a few artists over the years, self-confidence is always in short supply, at least for many people, not for all. Jim, that phone call can really begin to change things.
It can, and it's a validation that the work that we do is recognized and important.
Mm-hmm. What do you say when you make the phone call?
Oh, I'm always super awkward on that phone call because I'm just so giddy, you know. And
Call early in the morning?
No. We try to call the same day that the decision's made, so it's pretty late in the evening. Mm-hmm. Because you know people are anxious. They're like the process for us is that all of the finalists. So people do have to apply. They apply for this award. It's an open call. So you apply, and then there's several layers of process, and the final one is that there are studio visits. So and presentations for the performers. So you know, they have recently been visited by, these artists have recently been visited by major curators and critics and, you know, critics of or curators of museums, writers from major publications.
These are folks from all over the country?
Yes. We bring, you know, this year it was four jurors.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, these artists have just been in their studios with these people, and so we try to make the call that day and let them know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great moment.
I can only imagine.
I've had people cry on the phone.
I can believe me, David.
Yeah, Kate and I used to argue about who could make the call, you know, argue to make the calls. It's such happy calls.
Yeah.
But somebody mentioned confidence, and I think that's one characteristic there's been a huge improvement in the confidence of artists in this city and region over the last 15, 20 years that's manifests itself in many, many ways. I think that's really important.
Yeah. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation about the Charlotte Foundation, and we'll talk more about how this group has changed the community here in Kansas City. We'll get phone calls, too, at 816-235-2888. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we were live from the K for the Royals home opener. You can find that conversation from the broadcast at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the children's doctors are in with advice on seasonal allergies. Hear what's new and what's tried and true to get your children through the sneezing and itchy eyes of spring. Well, this hour we're talking about the Charlotte Street Foundation, which provides financial support to local artists, $10,000 a year for some of the grants. I'm visiting with Jim Woodfill, who's a former Charlotte Street Award winner. He now teaches at the Kansas City Art Institute. Amy Kligman is the current Charlotte Street Executive and Artistic Director. David Hughes founded this whole thing 20 years ago. 816-235-2888 is the number here. Let's go to some calls. And Mike from Kansas City, Missouri. Mike, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Mike.
I just wanted to make sure, and Jim knows John Puchek. John Puchek was the artist that lived on Charlotte Street. And it was a gathering place for a lot of the artists. And you know, John was one of the most creative people I've ever known. He was a guy that you either wanted to hug or strangle. He was not always had both feet in reality, but just amazing guy. And that was where a lot of the artists hung out. We'd have barbecues there, and bands would come play. And David Hughes discovered the action on Charlotte Street and started coming and became a big part of it also. And I just wanted to make sure that John Puchek was remembered in all this talk of Charlotte Street.
I'm glad, Mike. You want to remember him, David?
Yeah, Mike, thanks for this. It gives me goosebumps. I mean, meeting John Puchek, I was kind of a latecomer to all this. I met Puchek through Katie and Court Sinis, who had moved to town from the Bay Area. And 1985, his Charlotte Street Mission, which was on 54th and Charlotte. And it was a 24-hour a day, 7-day a week revolving door of art and music and food. And he welcomed everyone into the house and had such a huge impact.
Is that why you call it the Charlotte Street Foundation?
It was named after John Puchek.
Mm.
And in fact, the Saturday Night Fish Fry, well, Fish Fry Friday and Saturday Nights on KCUR, Chuck named that after John Puchek. Puchek used to come into the studio. I mean, I wasn't here for that, obviously, but would be listening on Saturday or Friday nights, and they played a song, Everybody Eats When They Come to My House, and Puchek would give some recipe. He called Chuck Charles and would hold forth for a bit with his recipe. He was a philosopher and just a royal person.
David, where does this passion for the arts come from with you? Because you're not an artist yourself, per se. So what's driven you here?
Per se, no, not at all. I don't know, actually. I mean, I took some art classes. I have no ear for music, although I love it.
You know what you like.
But I had a class from this Kirk Varnadeau, who became a curator of modern contemporary at the Museum of Modern Art. Freshman year at Stanford, I remember, and it was 5 days a week at 8 a.m. The lights would go out at 8:01. He'd start talking, and 55 minutes later, the bell would ring and the lights would come back up. There was something in the visual appreciation of all that for me. And as I worked at American Century, I loved it, but got involved on the art committee and in the philanthropic community. I don't know. It's a long and tangled road.
You know, I took a jazz appreciation course at Stanford, and it just flipped my world. And I've been just crazy about it ever since.
I think it's for me. I mean, that started it, but I think it was really meeting the artists and seeing work up front.
Yeah.
That really made a difference for me.
Yeah. Let me go back some phone calls here. And Ferris from Overland Park. Ferris, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Good morning. And thank you very much for taking my call. I'm a cancer scientist, and I happen to have a daughter who does art, and then we auction it for the cause of supporting cancer research. And basically, she has done this twice now, and she has been quite actually successful and very enthusiastic. She's only 14 years old. I was wondering if the Charlotte Foundation would look positively upon very young artists who have a cause in their heart and would have a mechanism to support them further. Obviously, when you give an award or any kind of encouragement to a very young mind,
right,
that would go a long way.
Amy, hop in here.
Right. Well, Charlotte Street historically has been pretty focused on artists that are kind of in the professional realm. So there have been opportunities, there have been moments where, say, an artist has led a project that has worked with younger artists. But we're very, like, artist-driven, and because of that, a lot of the things that we're organizing really are things that professional artists are organizing or are facilitating. But there are a number of organizations that provide scholarship and support for younger artists. So I hope that she finds that, and that then when she becomes a professional or becomes, you know, at the point that she's looking for, you know, kind of life beyond school, Charlotte Street would be there for her.
Mm-hmm. Amy, I want to be real clear here that Charlotte Street and the foundation is about a whole lot more than just visual art.
That's very true. So Charlotte Street did start off as a visual arts organization, but moved into supporting performing artists, writers. So that's very important to the work that we do. There's a performing artist award. We give two of those unrestricted cash grants a year to performing artists. And then there's also spaces for performing artists in the residency program. And in terms of Charlotte Street's future trajectory, we're thinking a lot about additional ways to kind of deepen our support for performing artists. Hmm. So they're very much a part of our future as well.
You know, Jim, I'm wondering, is it easier or harder to make a living in Kansas City as an artist today? What's your sense? Has that dynamic changed?
Well, it's how you do it. It has changed a lot there. And it goes back to that confidence thing. I think much of my income came from working in commercial art and in various freelance signage projects of a lot of different things. And I think that the kind of the foundation was set in the early part of this century for a broader support. Charlotte Street had a lot to do with it, but it was kind of across the board in Kansas City, a stronger foundation for supporting artists for the work that they want to do,
mm-hmm.
To amplify the public art programs that are in town. One was the Avenue of the Arts, which is now kind of morphed into Art in the Loop. And I noticed there are a lot of really young artists working on Art in the Loop right now in ways that I would never have dreamed of at that age.
You told our producer, Jim, that in some ways working as an artist today is even tougher than it was 20 years ago.
Well, it's I don't know that it's tougher. It's more competitive.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more competitive, and it
why is that?
There are more really good artists in town.
Trained by the Kansas City Art Institute.
Trained by the Kansas City Art Institute and supported by Charlotte Street Foundation.
Yeah.
For sure. And others from you know, UMKC has a great program and KU. And it's become a really competitive high temperature environment for artists.
One thing I'd add in terms of work, and you know, I'm not an artist as we discussed, so take this with a grain of salt. But I think artists are much more connected nationally than ever before. I think Kansas City used to be somewhat siloed, both within the large organizations nationally and among the artists and curators. And I think that's not true. Mm-hmm. I think we're part of the national conversation, and I think artists are seeking opportunities and are performing and exhibiting around the country and around the world.
Yeah.
And to be a successful artist, you almost have to, it's hard to just work here. I mean, you're based here, but you've got to get your work out.
Amy, do you ever get lobbied by the artist to win one of these things, or the friends of the artist?
Well, it wouldn't matter if they were lobbying, because I don't make those decisions. Yeah. But, you know, I think that... there are a lot of artists who come to Charlotte Street, and maybe they're coming because of the award, and really, like, the thing that they really need right now is actually the residency, and they don't even know about it. Or, you know, there are a lot of artists that come to Charlotte Street looking for opportunities to exhibit, and maybe they don't realize that we have, you know, La Esquina and other, like, kind of pop-up opportunities to have a platform for their work to be shown. Mm-hmm. So what we try to do is connect them to the opportunities that really are going to be critical for them at that point in their career.
Do I understand right, Amy, that you use some of the money from winning the award yourself to help pay for childcare? I'm wondering, how did that help your career as an artist back in the day?
Well, it didn't actually pay for childcare, but what it did pay for was it happened right after I had my first child. And the thing that could have gone away in terms of the stuff I could afford at that moment was my studio. Mm. And it enabled me to pay for my studio for a full year at that time. That was really critical. And, you know, my husband is an artist who also won the award, I should say, prior to my coming on the staff. But, you know, similarly, you know, I think it hit him at a critical moment where, you know, you kind of needed that extra nudge to keep going. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was that for both of us.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the art you were creating back then that helped you win this award.
Oh, well, my work was kind of, I would say, observational. It was about kind of looking at the world around me and commenting on what I saw. And they were paintings specifically and installations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Jim, how about your art? Tell our listeners about that.
I had just, I think a year or two before, had just finished the Freight House Signal project, which is still there. It's 20 years old this year. Mm-hmm. It was an opportunity to dive into the public art project from referencing other work that I was doing with flashing lights and spinning trash can lids and flying light bulbs and a lot of kinetic stuff and a lot of installation oriented work that really wasn't finding a great home in the gallery situation. Although I got to say that the gallerists in Kansas City have been so supportive of my work, although it's not quite in the sales category as other work. But
yeah, that, Amy.
Yeah, one thing I want to add to that is that part of the beauty of Charlotte Street is that because it's a non-commercial entity. The support that Charlotte Street offers is it's not tied to, it's no strings, right? So it's supporting the artist's vision in a very pure way. Mm-hmm. And I think that actually has had quite an effect on the character of the art being made in Kansas City, in that it's not necessarily market driven. It's not necessarily about what people want to buy or what people want to see. It's about what artists are reacting to. And I think that's a really magical thing.
I also want to mention Charlotte Street has been involved now in making these $6,000 project-based grants to back what you guys call innovative and risk-taking public arts projects. This work is in partnership with the Spencer Museum of Art and funded by the Andy Warhol Foundation, David, that you mentioned earlier. What are you trying to promote there by risk-taking public art?
The Rocket Grants are really there to support, again, projects that are stepping outside of that, like, kind of normative zone of art making.
Rocket Grants.
Yeah, they're called the Rocket Grants, and that's to kind of pick up on that notion that they are catalytic. Like, they're all about sparking new conversations, new collaborations, interesting kind of things that are initiated by artists, but they're happening in the public realm.
Are you guys doing anything else this year to celebrate your 20th anniversary?
Oh, we're doing a ton of things. It's endless, actually. Like small birthday parties. We have a program called Every Street is Charlotte Street where we're working with a lot of partners across the city.
Information on your website,
yes,
right?
Yes, that.
Okay. I want to thank Amy Kligman, the current Charlotte Street Executive and Artistic Director. David Hughes, who founded this thing 20 years ago. David, congratulations on seeing this thing through.
Thank you, Steve.
Jim Woodfill is a former Charlotte Street Award winner. He is now an associate professor in the painting department at the Kansas City Art Institute. Jim, thanks for your
time,
too. Good luck, guys. Well, it's time now for State House Blend Missouri. As a House-approved $27.8 billion state budget heads to the Senate, host Brian Ellison and political reporter Will Schmidt from the Springfield News Leader sat down with the Senate Appropriations Committee vice chair, that's Ryan Silvey, a Republican from Kansas City, to talk about who wins and who loses in this proposal and the process for crafting a state budget.
So there are different bills for the different departments. Each bill covers kind of one specific area of the budget, and they're ordered constitutionally by order of importance in the Constitution. So House Bill 1 is always debt. Debt's the first thing we have to pay. House Bill 2 is elementary and secondary education, which is the second priority behind debt. Then it goes higher education, and it kind of just filters on down.
So let's talk a little bit about the results of that, get to some of the substance of the budget that has now made its way out of the House and has come over to the Senate. It's $27.8 billion altogether. Will, I know you cover the whole State House, not just the budget, but what stands out to you about this budget?
I don't know. I was a little surprised about the that it was fully funded under the revised formula, but I was even more surprised how little that how little that seems to last. Senator Dan Brown, who chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee, I think he said even before they were finished third reading the bills that fully funding wasn't going to happen.
So you're talking about fully funding the foundation formula that funds K-12 education in Missouri.
Right. And there's a little behind the scenes there about if you fully fund the formula, then it triggers extra early childhood spending. And it's, of course, there's a common complaint from Democrats that, this isn't really fully funding the formula because we're still $500 million short under the previous formula. But I don't know. It's always interesting to watch.
I would say that's a tired argument since the previous formula hasn't existed for 12 years.
So we're getting into
I'm just relating that it's out there.
No, I get it. For sure. Let's get into the weeds just a little bit here. Let's try to unpack this. You guys both know what you're talking about, but a lot of people will not. The funding formula, the foundation formula, is a statute that the General Assembly has set up to say this is how the level at which education needs to be funded. It was last revised in 2005.
Correct.
Senator Silvey, you were in the House at that time. What's the thinking about how did that number get set where it is?
So back in 2005, we were in a situation where the number every year of the old formula was growing unsustainably. Like, there was just no way we were going to hit it. And remember, this is prior to the recession.
And is that because it reflected the actual costs of education?
It was set up on a process of heavily weighting towards local match, right? So like a school districts like I represent North Kansas City and Liberty School District. We have very high local levies where we've passed local property tax increases. So because we were getting so much local money, we were getting very little state money. But then it was disincentivizing other districts from raising their local property tax match because they were getting so much state money that they had no reason to raise there. So there was a real tax inequity at the local level. So that's kind of what kind of brought us to the situation. We shifted to a more pupil-focused formula in 05, where we're going to look at, okay, how many kids do you have in your district? What are we setting as a statutory guideline for how much the state should spend on each kid? And then weight that based on percentage of free and reduced lunch, amount of special needs children, and the different cost factors that are involved there. So it's a very complicated formula that went from being property tax based to being student focused is kind of the argument that we went through.
Now Will Schmidt just made the point that a lot of legislators, a lot of people in the state say that the new number, which is not so new anymore, right, 2005, right, is not high, right, enough. That it's not, that it doesn't really provide enough money for education.
Yeah, and you know, frankly, we don't hear that argument a lot. At least I don't hear that from parents. You know, we are spending $3 billion on elementary and secondary education in general revenue. We also have a constitutional requirement of how much general revenue should go to free public schools, I think is what it says in the Constitution, free public schools, which is 25% of general revenue. We're actually like 34-35%. So
way above what the Constitution requires.
Way above what the Constitution, which is why you don't ever see Missouri in the courts fighting over whether or not it's, unlike our neighbors to the west that are always in court about how much they should be funding schools. So we're never in court because of it. But, you know, I think that I commend Representative Fitzpatrick for funding the formula. You know, I'm one of the few people left in the legislature who was there in 05 who voted for that. And I've always felt that it was a personal commitment of mine to try and get to what I thought was a good, you know, to fully funding what I said should be the law.
But the big news that Will just named is about early childhood funding, which the funding is tied, the requirement level for that funding is tied to whether the foundation formula is funded, right?
Correct.
So what's happening with that in the House version?
Frankly, I haven't looked at whether or not they tackled that issue or whether they ignored it. I don't know. And we'll go over. We're starting to go through the bills on Tuesday.
Sure. A couple other things I want to ask about. Last week on the podcast, one of our guests was Representative Mark Ellerbrocht, who I believe his district intersects with your Senate district. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And he raised a concern, a question. Concern is probably not stating it strongly enough. Here's how he answered one of my questions to him.
I mean, are you suggesting that the Senate President Pro Tem, in fact, has been bought for campaign contributions?
I'm not suggesting it. I'm saying it. He has. Look at the numbers.
He's accused Senator Richard of some pretty serious things, being beholden to and bought by campaign donors. That's the leader of your party in the Senate, Ryan Silvey. What do you think about that?
I mean, the facts are what they are. I'm not willing to go so far as to say that Senator Richard violated the law, but I'm also not a law enforcement agency. I would leave that up to them.
So what does that mean? You said you would support some investigation. By whom?
Well, I mean, look, the facts are he received large contributions. He filed legislation that would dismiss a lawsuit against the people who made those large contributions. Now, it's not for me to determine motive. It's not for me to determine if that was a quid pro quo. If somebody wanted to look into it, I don't think anyone would be surprised. But I do think, you know, there's been a pattern of behavior with this leadership team that certainly would lead you to conclude that people who have made significant contributions got their legislation put to the front of the line of consideration. When you look at how the calendar was ordered this year, when you look at how certain bills have been handled. And, you know, in the past, since I've been around, there was a previous speaker who was investigated for something very similar. For sending a bill to a committee specifically to kill it after receiving a contribution from someone who was against it. So, you know, I think, again, whether or not the Senate should have ethics committee, I don't even sit on the ethics committee, I think. But then probably the difficulty of that is the people who do sit on the ethics committee are the people that you're talking about. So I doubt that you would see them investigate themselves.
Are you it seems like you're saying something pretty significant that in terms of that you're criticizing the leadership of your own caucus there in the Senate in a pretty significant way.
Well, I think they deserve it. I think that that again, the way that they have ordered the calendar, the way that if you look at how bills have been handled, there are approximately 60 bills this session that were referred to different committees last year than they were referred to this year. And several of them, it would be questionable as to whether the committee they were sent to was the appropriate committee of jurisdiction or if it was sent there because of who the chairman was and how the leadership would anticipate the chairman would handle that bill. I don't think that's how the Senate's supposed to operate, and I have been critical of it, and I think rightfully so.
Is that coming at a cost to you?
Well, I'm not chairman of appropriations, so I think you know, it probably is. I've had one bill on the calendar, you know, so it probably has.
Hey, that's Will Schmidt of the Springfield News Leader. Will, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for giving me a chance.
And Senator Ryan Silvey, a Republican from Kansas City North, thank you as always.
Thank you.
What music captures this moment in your life and the life of the Missouri Senate?
So I'm wearing a Who shirt today, but I've already used the Who on the program. So I'm going to go with Life's Been Good, Joe Walsh.
Statehouse Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.
That was an excerpt from Statehouse Blend Missouri. You can get the inside scoop on Missouri politics by subscribing on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's program, how to recognize the symptoms and treat allergies in children. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tata Coro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.